You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, we're packed. Mark Joseph Stern, staff writer at Slate, on Breyer's successor and the Supreme Court okaying the diminishment black voting power in Alabama. Then Dr. Anel Shaleen, Middle East research fellow at the Quincy Institute, on our continued involvement in the war on Yemen. Meanwhile, COVID cases down in nearly every state in the union as it comes closer to a mask-off moment. Wake of Macron meeting Putin. Seems to be a slight de-escalation of the potential conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Meanwhile, the House to vote on a continued resolution kicking the can on a budget for a month today. And Jill Biden, where's she been? Says that Joe Biden's free community college plan, it's dead. Meanwhile, Peter Thiel quits Facebook, or Meta, or whatever they're calling it today. They're bored to help the flailing J.D. Vance and to other Republican Trump candidates.
We need help, Daddy.
Iran talks may be closing in on a new nuke deal. Trump gives up documents that he illegally took from the White House. No word on whether he used a different email. Virginia Governor Youngkin campaign attacks a high schooler who complained about Youngkin's possible rollback of an anti-slavery program centered around the Virginia governor's mansion. And the weight of the FTC sinks NVIDIA's bid to monopolize the chip market in this country. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. With me, as she is every day, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. I got nothing.
All right. That was a very decided intonation at the end of that hello.
Although I will say, anyone, I'm still thinking about this documentary on Netflix. Watch The Tinder Swindler. It is nuts.
The Tinder Swindler?
Swindler, yeah.
Okay. What is that about?
It's about a guy who... Well, I don't want to give too much away, but basically he met women on Tinder claiming to be the son of an Israeli billionaire.
Oh, that works, incidentally, I should tell you.
Takes them on private planes, and he's defrauding them. But it gets even crazier, so definitely watch it.
I will check that out. Speaking of swindlers, there was, and just to let people know, there was a tweet thread by a guy, by Eli Ehrlich. I don't know who Eli is, but apparently they were contacted to do a documentary ostensibly on trans people or gender. They are using a front called the Gender Unity Project, and it's Matt Walsh. Mm. That creepy guy who works with the other creepy guy, Ben Shapiro, at that creepy website. So check it out. I don't know where they're getting the names of people, who they're trying to trick to get into this documentary. I have no idea what they would have done at that point, but
presumably cherry picked it for the most the parts that they can make look most impressive.
Right.
Without a doubt, it is a way in which they're going to. It's a vehicle for their transphobia.
Yeah.
What they're going to do with it, who knows? But that is undoubtedly what what they're up to. So just be careful.
It's like a honeypot situation where they're trying to. I'm doubtful that they'll represent anything that's said in that documentary if you're recruited by it in its full context.
No, but if you have some free time, go do some counterintelligence and act like you want to help them out and give them some.
Apparently they have a fake website, I think it is. Maybe it's the Gender Unity Project. Maybe a lot of people should visit that at the same time. Anyways, trying to pull a fast one, as you know, and we are efforting this, we've gotten requests, I think, about some of the organizers for this. There is an attempt to unionize Amazon workers in Staten Island, New York. One of the five boroughs of New York. Staten Island, people forget sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not from New York, you probably can't even name all five boroughs one way or another. I don't know.
I mean, you can name a few, but
it's in a lot of rap. Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, Staten.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you.
Yeah, see that? You forgot the Bronx.
The Bronx.
All right.
He was in the Wu-Tang Clan.
Here's the point, though, is they're having meetings, Amazon is, to dissuade people from joining a union. This is one of the problems that we have in this country, that employers have the ability to force workers to attend meetings where they can explain why a union's not good for them. And of course, union organizers don't have the same opportunity to meet with workers. Now, sometimes what happens is more savvy members of the workforce at a certain company will try and inform their fellow workers when they're being lied to by management. And sometimes what they'll do is, even on their days off, they will attend these meetings. And that's a big bummer for management, because they don't want someone there who knows what they're talking about to correct or to inform workers as to what's going on. This is one of the advantages that the management has in these union drives.
And the fact that they employ them and pay them.
Aside from the coercion.
Right, exactly.
And here is a leaked video that came from Status Quo News during a mandatory meeting of Amazon workers in Staten Island. And some of the fellow workers there who took their own time, they're not on company time at this, to come to the meeting, are being threatened by Amazon for being at the meeting, and their jobs being threatened, as if the Amazon, the bosses, had the opportunity or the right to dictate what their these workers do on their free time. Listen to this.
We also know that you understand that if you make us leave the room, that's a charge against Amazon.
Is this a non-working?
Is this a no-work area?
I said it three times already.
Can you answer my question, Felipe?
Three times. If you were not scheduled to be in the room for this particular meeting, I asked you to leave the room.
I asked you.
We don't have it.
Yeah, we're staying. We're staying.
Not leave the room and be in support.
We're staying. Felipe, we're times. Organizing on our non-work time.
This is legally protected collective action by the law. You know that.
That's the general manager.
We allow them to go. They want to go.
We're protected under Section 7A. We're protected under Section
7A.
And this is the same reason why we're in this room, because Amazon does a lot of things just like this.
Everyone is
like, yes, we're going to be here. You guys are continuously breaking law.
This is what we're going to do. We are going to get this sentence started, right? We're going to get this sentence started. I very clearly told everyone who was not scheduled to be here to leave the room, and you decided to stay. So we're going to get this sentence started, so right.
By the general
we won't
manager,
stop this.
And saying they will be in support,
right?
If we don't leave.
Thank you.
We'll file more charges. Get ready for them.
That was good. That was good.
Now, I don't know how that resolved, but basically, just so everybody understands what's going on there, this guy, who's apparently a general manager, is telling people who are not, I guess, have been invited necessarily to that meeting or on a work shift that they have to leave. But it is a non-work area. And so they have a right to be there and to organize in a non-work area.
And he says, leave or you'll be
labeled
insubordinate.
Insubordinate,
yeah.
Which, of course, is some type of like demerit on your record there. And it is, you know, it's unclear to me that these people were in any way being, you know, stopping the meeting. They were just asking questions to clarify because Felipe, the general manager there, is undoubtedly trying to tell the other workers, like, hey, Amazon's great. We empower all of you, except for if you have questions.
I mean, have you seen those ads, too? There is a full-on, PR campaign by Amazon with people saying, I make $15 an hour here. I never was able to do that in my previous forklift job. As if they weren't forced into doing so by Bernie publicly declaring and threatening them with that Stop Bezos Act that he had a few years ago. That was a lot of his own doing. And this particular plant has engaged in terrible practices for a while. I mean, if people recall, this is an effort that's 2 years in the making here in the Staten Island plant, because Chris Smalls, he was the one who was retaliated against for attempting to demand better working conditions during the pandemic. So, I mean, solidarity with all of them in the Staten Island plant, because this has been a long time coming there.
And we will continue to follow that as well.
Yeah, and I just like to, it's great to see footage like that leak. That was a status quo. But these sorts of meetings, I think, like letting people see them before they're sort of like put into the situation and see how you can actually react and modeled by these people in this video is really important.
Really important to know what rights you have as a worker in these contexts. Just a reminder, we're doing live shows. There is not much more time for you to get a ticket to the Brooklyn show. You got a little bit of time for the Boston show. That's not happening till May, but those tickets are going to sell out soon, too. Head over to MajorityLive.com. Click on the link, Boston, Brooklyn. And I got news for you. You could go to both if you wanted.
March 26th.
Maybe we'll get like a prize for people who go to both or something. I don't know what that would be.
What's the prize?
I don't know. I just it occurred to me. I haven't figured it out yet.
We could take a selfie with you or something.
Everybody can take a selfie with me if they want. But maybe we'll do like a signed picture of all of us or something.
Oh, okay.
That could be good.
Yeah.
All right. And don't forget,
I was rationing the selfies. I apologize.
Do an NFT, maybe.
Don't forget. We'll do an NFT. Don't forget. Also, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. All right. We got a couple of guests today. I want to get to them. Let's first bring in Mark Joseph Stern. He's staff writer at Slate and writing about the judiciary, the Supreme Court in particular, often. Mark, welcome back to the program. I'm here with Emma Viglin.
Thanks so much for having me on. Hi, Emma. Hi. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Mark.
So, all right, we got a lot to talk about, and more than we thought, I think, when we booked you yesterday. Obviously, this Alabama case, we'll get to that in a bit. Briefly, and we don't have too much time to go deep into Justice Breyer, but I thought your piece on his characterizing him as not being up to the moment was spot on. I mean, I have some other issues with his work, like on antitrust over the years. He's pretty bad on that. But really, well, you explain. Like, what do you mean by that? He wasn't up to the moment.
Well, look, I also have my issues with Breyer in areas of criminal justice, especially. He sometimes would side with the conservatives. But in that piece, I was more talking about his leadership of the liberal bloc, specifically after Justice Ginsburg died. So there is a very well-established role for the most senior justice in the minority bloc on the court to kind of lead their tribe through the deserts and bring them to a place where they can at least make their voice heard, speak collectively and strongly in their anger with the majority, sort of plant a flag and say, this is dangerously wrong, and fight those decisions as fiercely as they can, and try to convince the next generation of lawyers to disavow them and reject the majority's philosophy. And Breyer just wasn't good at that. He was temperamentally so modest and restrained and navel-gazing that he never really found his voice as a leader of the liberals. He almost always sounded conciliatory. He was always searching for an elusive compromise that never materialized. He was the opposite of Justice Sotomayor, who will become the new leader of the liberal bloc, who really, you know, took the gloves off and pulled no punches over the last few years. And so I felt like it was his time to step down for many reasons, one of them being he just couldn't be an effective voice for the three-justice minority. He was not doing the job that he was required of him in this position.
What is that unwillingness, right? Do you attribute it more to like an old school perspective on how justices should be more ivory tower, almost stenographers, or people who are making decisions that are above these things? Like, is getting down and dirty in the way that Sotomayor is likely to do, is that seen by some generation of justices as beneath the position?
Yes, I think that's part of it. Specifically, the generation of justices who were on the court in the 90s and the aughts. During that period, the court went its longest stretch without any change in personnel, nearly a dozen years. And all of those justices really got to know each other, became friends, settled into their groove. This was when Breyer came of age as a justice. And they were all relatively nice to each other. Yes, Scalia was often barbed and could be nasty, whatever. But I think Breyer just had this conception of the court as a tranquil, collegial, warm place where people could put their disagreements aside and keep the temperatures down and just engage intellectually. And that era is long gone with Kavanaugh and Barrett on the bench. Like, this is not the time to be conciliatory if you are on the left. Neil Gorsuch does not have a conciliatory bone in his body. And Breyer was still playing by the old rules and just couldn't figure out how to address this rising tide of churlishness and rage and aggression that was coming from the right. So I do think it was an older school philosophy and a reflection of his many years where the justices were genuinely collegial to each other and the right bloc wasn't just constantly trying to eat the left bloc's lunch.
And this is more than, an aesthetic, right? I mean, because this is... We are entering into a period, and we don't know how long it's going to be. It could be 10 years. It's more than likely probably going to be 20 years, maybe 30 years, where the laws of this country are going to dramatically shift to the right. The ability of government to function in the way that we have grown up with it, frankly, all of us, is going to change. The ability of the federal government to protect people's voting rights is going to change. All of these things are going to change dramatically. I don't think that your average person on the street is going to be aware of it on any given point. There's going to be a little bit of a boiling frog quality. But lawyers who are interested in this and who are pursuing judgeships, they're going to know. So the failure of Breyer to do this is not just about aesthetics, and it's not just about, you know, sort of like, right? It really is about coming out with forceful positions that for lawyers coming up 10, 20, 30 years ago who want to be able to reverse this in the same way that we had justices reverse it in really the 30s, in the 40s, to allow for things like the New Deal and for things like child labor laws and for, I mean, a whole host of things that define our society, our modern society today. This is giving, this is about basically planting seeds and giving, creating branches for future lawyers to undo some of the horrible things that are about to happen in this country for the next 10, 20 years.
I think that's right. And I think one illustration of the problem is that if you go up to an average lawyer or law student and say, like, what is Breyer's legal philosophy? What is his jurisprudential outlook? It's hard to give an answer because he liked to compromise. He liked to do trade-offs and bargains to kind of meet in the middle. He famously did this with Sandra Day O'Connor a great deal. Whereas if you asked about Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor, both of them have very sharply established and entrenched views on the law, which they are not apologetic about, which they stick to even when under fire and in the minority, and that I think help current generations of law students and future generations reject the majority's view and the majority's dogmas and say, no, I agree with Elena Kagan. Administrative agencies have a legitimate right to interpret and enforce federal law to protect us from pollution and fraud and all these other terrible things. Or Sonia Sotomayor, who says, you know, the Constitution protects our bodily autonomy. We must read it to protect individual rights, to protect criminal defendants. That is its first line of defense. This structural stuff about states and federal power, that is political. That is for the other branches to sort out. Breyer did not have any kind of philosophy that was so clear. He kind of bended and shifted. He was an admin law professor for years, but that didn't come out in his writings the way you might expect. It ended up sort of pushing him toward acting like a bureaucrat sitting in some obscure federal agency rather than a justice on the Supreme Court. So yeah, I agree with that take for sure.
And I think people also need to understand that it's almost, I mean, it's, I think it's always been this way, in my opinion. I mean, but it has become far less obscured and far more intense that we have almost two parallel tracks of political systems in this country, as it exists now. I mean, you know, I would argue three. Maybe there's one that is sort of nascent in terms of movement building outside of it. But we have the electoral politics, and we have these sort of like, you know, it, almost what is really now, in many respects, another political system that is what we call the legal system, and. For the past, I don't know, 25, 30 years with the Federalist Society, there has been a new force within the legal system that is making it even more, it has changed the rules of the way that law is, adjudicated and in many respects developed, in many respects struck down. And this is why, you know, having a, someone like a Kagan or a Sotomayor, and I would argue someone to the left of them would be better on a lot of things, but to have people who are providing a trail for the other sort of like future judges, right? I mean, that's what this is all about.
Yes, and this is something that, William Brennan and Thurgood Marshall did brilliantly throughout the 70s and 80s through the Berger Court and the Rehnquist Court, and planted some flags that later the Supreme Court actually decided, yeah, we need to revisit this, like Bowers v. Hardwick upholding anti-sodomy laws. You know, the dissent in that case paved the way for its reversal years later, and the court adopted the view of the dissent. I mean, there's a great line in Lawrence v. Texas, which overturned that decision, where the court says, you know what, the dissenters were right then, they're right today, and we're adopting their view. And I like to imagine that in 20 or 30 years, there will be decisions in which future justices say, Sonia Sotomayor in dissent was right then, she's right today, and we're adopting her view. And you need to have a powerful and clear vision in order for that kind of prescience to emerge from your own opinions. And again, like, you know, Breyer was liberal for the most part. He voted in a lot of important cases the right way, say marriage equality or anti-sodomy laws or some, you know, administrative state laws. But at the end of the day, he didn't have a vision. He didn't have the prescience. And I think that several people on Biden's shortlist do and several don't. And I'm just really hoping that we learn more about them and Biden whittles down the options very wisely with this particular issue and this particular foresight in mind.
All right, let's talk about those options. And I just have to add, had Breyer had what you bemoan he lacks, he would have announced his retirement this time last year, in my opinion, because he would have understood what's happening with the court and how important it is. And, you know, knock on wood, we have Ben Lujan out in it right now. There is no effective. We couldn't confirm somebody today. Hopefully we'll be able to in a matter of weeks. Who are the top picks in which and give us your assessment of them?
So we are told, and I believe this is correct, that there are three on the shortlist. They are Ketanji Brown Jackson, Leandra Kruger, and Michelle Childs. Ketanji Brown Jackson currently sits on the D.C. Circuit, which is sort of the second highest court, often a springboard to SCOTUS. She served for about 8 years on the federal district court here in D.C. before that. Leandra Kruger is a justice on the California Supreme Court, where she is known as a kind of centrist who can bridge the gap between the left and right flanks. And Michelle Childs is currently a federal judge on the district court in South Carolina. She's been nominated to the D.C. Circuit, and she is, we are told, a favorite of Jim Clyburn, a very powerful kind of kingmaker. He is pushing her for this spot, and Lindsey Graham has decided to join him and say that Michelle Childs is the consensus pick. I would rank them in the order I just listed them. KBJ is my number one. Leandra Kruger is my number two. Big drop, and Michelle Childs is my number three.
Well, so, and you say, like, you know, we are told that Jim Clyburn is pushing Michelle Childs. No, he is screaming from the rooftops, it seems like. And he, the other day, was quoted and basically said that this pick has to be bipartisan. It cannot be passed if the there's not bipartisan support behind the Supreme Court pick, which is BS. And to me, what I'm fearful of is that this seems to be gaining some steam. Maybe it's because Clyburn's talking to every paper that will listen and is pushing her very publicly, but I'm a little bit fearful that this kind of campaign is going to work, even though Labor has spoken out against Childs a bit.
Right. And Labor has spoken out against her because, of course, she was a management side lawyer, a corporate lawyer who litigated against unions and against labor. And I think it's great that we're seeing these criticisms of her record, because that's how the Federalist Society thinks when the Federalist Society is vetting its own judges and justices. And I think that the left could learn a great deal from how FedSoc vets its own people. You do not just look at a handful of their decisions if they're on the bench, or a handful of their cases if they're litigators. You need to ask if they lived their values. And in FedSoc, that means they devoted themselves to abolishing abortion rights and gay equality and dismantling the administrative state. On the left, that means incentivizing, boosting up labor, encouraging unionization, helping criminal defendants, encouraging LGBTQ equality, abortion access, all of that stuff. Michelle Childs did not live her values. She cashed in as a corporate lawyer. Many people do that. I'm not saying it's the worst thing in the world, but compare her to Ketanji Brown Jackson, who was a federal public defender for many years, who zealously defended a Guantanamo Bay detainee to such a degree that the Daily Caller is currently running a ridiculous hit piece on her, accusing her of basically sympathizing with terrorists. I think the left should look at those two options and say, choose your fighter. Would you like the union busting corporate lawyer, or would you like the person who is so committed to the Fifth and Sixth Amendments, to defending unpopular criminal defendants, that she went out to Guantanamo Bay and put her career and reputation on the line? This was a very controversial thing in the mid-aughts, to defend due process and habeas rights of these individuals who were deemed enemy combatants. I think that's an easy choice. I am a little bit puzzled why Jim Clyburn doesn't agree.
Well, I can come up with a lot of reasons why Jim Clyburn doesn't agree with you, but let's put that aside for a moment, because the other aspect of this, This is important, and on some level, I am just speaking to my dad, and maybe to Emma's folks too here, because there are generations of lawyers who do not understand this concept, which is that the Federalist Society has been able to make being a member of the Federalist Society a non-starter. If you're not a member of the Federalist Society, you will not get appointed to be a judge by a Republican president ever under any circumstances at this point. And
they have like cocktail parties where they audition.
There's a whole network. But the point being is that they dictate the career paths of lawyers coming out of law school to go into certain types of law to make certain types of decision from day one. You come out of law school, you're 22 years old, 24 years old, 25 years old, wherever it is, there are specific routes that you take if you want to become a federal judge. You got to clerk here, or you got to serve in the, you got to work for this corporate firm, or you got to do this. On the left, we need to do something like that as well. And they successfully used, and I can't remember who the nominee was, a membership in the American Constitution Society, which is, you know, the sort of left's attempt to create a Federalist Society type of as a detriment in past years. The Republicans were able to use that against it. There needs to be on the left a system and a funnel where you are rewarded for being a public defender. You are rewarded for fighting against corporations polluting. You're rewarded for a whole host of things, values that we want lawyers to have, and we want society to look that way. So it's not just a question of you can't hold a lawyer's clients against them. We've got to end that when it comes to judgeships.
Yes. And I would sort of elaborate on this a bit. The reason that FedSoc has been so successful isn't just that it brings people into this clubby network and boosts their careers. It's that many of those individuals end up getting boosted to the federal judiciary. And so the ultimate prize as you're going up the ladder is often a federal judgeship after years of lucrative corporate work, usually. And I would say, like, obviously the American Constitution Society is not a real alternative to FedSoc. I completely agree with you that the left needs to build out an infrastructure that creates a real pipeline from law school straight to the federal courts that incentivizes progressive advocacy. I think that Joe Biden is doing the most a president possibly can to help create that infrastructure now, because he is very actively and conscientiously rewarding people like Ketanji Brown Jackson, who lived their values, with federal judgeships, rewarding Black women who refuse to cash out and go into corporate work, rewarding an unprecedented number of LGBTQ people, of women, of people of color, who did not just go to Jones Day and help bust unions or whatever, but actually went and did the hard work of protecting civil liberties and protecting important regulations. They are now getting judgeships as well. And so a generation of law students right now are looking at this pipeline that Biden has kind of created or facilitated and saying, that could be me. I could also start on this path. They can't do it as easily as FedSoc because they can't just sign a form and pay dues and get on the fast track to the courts. But we are starting to see this infrastructure develop. And it's one reason why I have been very critical of Biden not nominating any reproductive rights advocates to the federal judiciary thus far, because young, very excited and ambitious law students are going to look and see that Biden hasn't nominated abortion rights lawyers and say, well, defending abortion rights as your primary career path must be a poison pill, so I'm going to avoid doing it. And that is the exact opposite message that the White House should be sending, because George W. Bush nominated a bunch of people who spent their entire careers litigating against abortion, who said abortion is an evil on par with slavery and I am devoting myself to destroying it. They got federal judgeships. A generation of lawyers decided that attacking abortion was the way to go, and they are now going to overturn Roe v. Wade. So there needs to be a big picture attitude here where we look at every single progressive cause and make sure that there's real representation. But Biden is doing almost as good a job as you could expect. And now I think the work falls on the progressive legal community to back him up, building out that pipeline further.
This is it's such an important point. I'm so glad you've been talking about this, because it really there just broadly is not an appreciation of that, and it allows people to see what's been going on the right, and you know how also we should say, you know, a lot of these you know, when McConnell pushed through 180, I think it was, lifetime federal appointments,
234
over the course of 4 years. So many of them also were hiding the ball because they also knew that was part of the strategy as well. But everybody could be sure where, you know, how they were going to adjudicate. There's not going to be any suitors. We're never going to see a David Souter again, where a Republican president is going to appoint somebody who later like, well, actually he seems a little bit more moderate than we thought at the time. All right. So with that said, let's talk about what happened with Alabama. I mean, it is stunning, and it's stunning the way they did it. It is so blatant. All right, just tell us what the ruling, to the extent that it was a ruling, I mean, it was really just like a switch flicked, essentially. But tell us what it was.
So are we allowed to curse on this show? That might be helpful. No.
I will give you special dispensation.
This decision was fucked up beyond my capacity to explain in the time we have left, but I will try, because there is one provision of the Voting Rights Act that remained until last night that was genuinely enforced that the Supreme Court hadn't yet hobbled. And that was its ban on racial gerrymandering. This is a core component of the VRA, so important that when the Supreme Court last weakened it in the early 80s, Congress came back and redid the VRA to ensure that this would stand as a bar against racial gerrymandering. When I say racial gerrymandering, what I mean is a state packing as many Black voters as possible into a single district and then distributing the remaining few throughout a bunch of majority white districts so Black people can only elect at most one representative. That is exactly what Alabama did here. Alabama, the percentage of Black people who live in Alabama is about 27 to 30% of Alabama residents are Black. This new map that Republicans drew in Alabama, 7 districts, Black people make up a majority of only one of them. So Black people control 14% of congressional districts in a state where they make up nearly a third of the total population. That is just blatantly and brazenly illegal under the VRA. The whole point of this provision of the VRA is that you can't carve up Black communities so that you have one crazy district that packs almost all of them in, and then a bunch of other districts where they're distributed and can't really elect their preferred representatives. So how obviously illegal is this? A 3-judge court with 2 Donald Trump appointees, 2 of 3 judges on this court were appointed by Donald Trump with Mitch McConnell's assent. They held that this was a blatantly illegal racist gerrymander. They said, come on, guys, you did not even try. They held a trial. They had thousands of pages of motions and declarations. They had all of these hearings. They issued a 225-page opinion, meticulously laying out all of the reasons why this was obviously a racial gerrymander. And they said, Alabama, you've got to redo this. You've got to unpack all of these Black voters and give them a real chance of electing another preferred representative. The Supreme Court steps in at the very last minute and without any reasoning, without any explanation, issues an order blocking that decision by the 3-judge court indefinitely, ensuring that the illegal map will be used in 2022 and probably for the rest of the decade. No reasoning. And it was so outrageously wrong that John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, the architect of the assault on the Voting Rights Act, the guy who was in the Justice Department in the 1980s trying to prevent Congress from amending it to block racial gerrymandering, he dissented from this decision. John Roberts said that this decision was wrong because the lower court obviously got it right. If that is not proof that this is a completely lawless order, I just don't know what proof would look like.
Just so the people know, I mean, this is a rough sketch I just did. This is what the district looks like, right? You have up here and here where the highest densities of black people are. And they literally had to draw it like this to essentially make sure that there was no black voting power distributed in anywhere except for this one district. And just to explain to people, when you say there's no reasoning, there was no explanation, you're not being, this is not hyperbole. There was literally no reasoning, no explanation. Explain how that can be.
The shadow dockets, which is the way that the Supreme Court often makes law now, is the term that we use.
This is recent. This is recent, right? I mean,
The shadow docket, as we know it, did not exist until Brett Kavanaugh joined the court. And it did not really take off until Amy Coney Barrett joined the court. Before Kavanaugh and Barrett, the court just wasn't doing this stuff. It was not issuing these emergency orders in these big cases. It was not issuing them at midnight or in the evening or randomly, dramatically overhauling the law, refusing to explain its reasoning. This is solely the result of a very aggressive and empowered five-justice ultra-conservative majority saying, we don't need to hold oral arguments. We don't need full briefing. We don't need your respect precedent. We're just going to do whatever we want and not even pretend to act like a court. We're just going to act like a legislature passing bills that say this is the result.
It's not even like that. It's not even like that. Honestly, it's not. I mean, in a legislature passing a bill, there would be debate. There would be some process. This is just like, this is it right here. It's just up or down. I mean, you know, Siskel Ebert spent more time explaining why they did. This is just literally thumbs up, thumbs down, boom, we're done.
It's more like the gladiator situation in terms of the stakes that we're talking about.
Yes. And so that's what the court did last night. Just gave a thumbs down. And in doing so, pretty much blew up the Voting Rights Act or what remained of it. Because, as I said, if this is not a racial gerrymander prohibited by the Voting Rights Act, there is no such thing as a racial gerrymander. I mean, this is the most egregious example you could come up with. It's textbook. And so the five ultra-conservatives just said thumbs down. One paragraph, no explanation, no reasoning. Brett Kavanaugh wrote this snitty little petulant concurrence that was basically responding to Elena Kagan's excellent dissent, which I encourage everyone to read. He was trying to explain his reasoning. It's very muddled. It really doesn't make a lot of sense. He implied that he and that his colleagues have just totally overhauled and rewritten the rules by which the court operates and is now issuing these decisions basically on the merits. It used to be that the court could not legally intervene unless one party had a slam dunk case. And now he said, well, we're making up new rules. Now, if we think it's kind of close, we're just going to step in and rule for the state and allow it to keep its racist voting laws. That's new. He didn't really explain why or how that rule came to be, but that's apparently our new governing rule. But he wasn't even writing for the majority. He was just explaining his own vote because he got pissed that Elena Kagan absolutely pantsed him in her dissent.
I mean,
I don't love that visual, but
I mean, at this point, it's like, you know, and this is not the first of these type of things, although I think it could be one of the most egregious in terms of the vote. I mean, where, you know, the importance of the Voting Rights Act, the now 8-year, 9-year, I guess, assault on it is nearly complete. We should remind people, too, that supposedly they don't even seem to articulate this anymore. You know, original intent and, you know, activist court. We don't even hear the right use those terms anymore, because when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, people should understand this. It was reauthorized in 2007, I believe it was, with like, what, 98-2 in the Senate. I mean, there could be no greater expression of what the legislator wanted to do, what lawmakers wanted to do, than that reauthorization. And that reauthorization was completely scoffed at by the Roberts Court in 2013 when they gutted Section 5. And subsequent to that, they've just been putting it through a meat grinder.
And essentially, the way that they describe their reasoning was that, well, we looked into the hearts of the legislatures and we realized that they were guilted into reauthorizing.
Yeah, they were afraid. Basically. They were afraid.
And Justice Scalia, famously, when confronted with this argument about how it was overwhelmingly reauthorized, he said, well, it's a perpetuation of racial entitlement. Those are the terms that he used. And so he said, of course, Congress isn't going to step in and take away this racial entitlement that's created this windfall for Black people. You know, it's us, the court, that has the constitutional duty to be brave where Congress couldn't and tell Black voters, you just don't deserve these protections anymore.
And so what is being done from your perspective to sort of like heighten the awareness of what's going on with the courts? I mean, I am convinced that if I had to pick one reason why Donald Trump became president, I think it was Mitch McConnell keeping that seat open. I think that more than anything else, there were millions of theocrats out there who are like, this is our opportunity to get rid of abortion. Now, I think there was a whole host of other things like the Voting Rights Act, et cetera, that a lot of other Republicans were savvy enough to understand, and corporatists who were savvy enough to understand the implications of this. But I think keeping that seat open, because the right has an appreciation for these things. Do you see anything by the administration, by the body politic, by the Democratic Party, by anybody to sort of make voters understand the relationship between their vote and the diminishment of Black voting in Alabama? And we could keep going on and on and on, but the loss of sovereignty of women's body, but then also, you know, the ability of government to say to corporations, you can't pour your mercury into the water.
So I think the Biden administration has totally dropped the ball. Biden had his study commission on the court. It issued its report, which was sort of like mishy mushy, didn't explain any kind of conclusions, just said, well, the court is a land of contrasts, and moved on. And Biden has just ignored it since. I think that some Democrats in Congress are leading the way here. People like Mondaire Jones, who are going out there and jumping up and down and saying these decisions are awful and eroding our democracy. Some of them have sponsored the Judiciary Act of 2022, which would add 4 seats to the Supreme Court, which is the only real solution here. And beyond that kind of core of activist, progressive lawmakers, you are seeing some consensus among Democrats that the court needs to be reined in. And I think Exhibit A here is that one of the voting rights bills that passed the House, sadly died in the Senate, actually included a court reform provision that would have at least ostensibly prohibited the Supreme Court from doing what it did last night, that would have barred the Supreme Court from intervening to block a Voting Rights Act action in a state on the basis that, as Kavanaugh said, it was like too close to an election. The House Democrats almost unanimously said, we're going to change the court's rules, which is within Congress's power. That's actually something that Congress can do, even if it doesn't do it often. So I think Democrats are waking up to this, but it's too late, and they aren't necessarily cluing in their constituents that at the end of the day, the Supreme Court is the most powerful policymaking institution in this country, will be for decades, and everyone needs to pay way more attention to it than they currently do.
Mark Joseph Stern, we're out of time. I want to have you back so we can talk about the crap show that is the affirmative action ruling and a whole host of other rulings that are taking place. You know, and frankly, the ruling they had on the mandate in OSHA, I think that's going to have a lot of implications in terms of like the non-delegation doctrine and Chevron. And these are things that we need to talk about. I mean, to the extent that we can educate a small amount of people as to the importance of this stuff, I really appreciate you coming on and doing it.
Anytime, Sam. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Let's go. We have Dr. Anil Shaleen here, Middle East Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute. Do we have her? Okay. Anil, thank you so much for joining us. I'm here with Emma Vigeland, and apologize for keeping you waiting, but we were rather exercised about the Supreme Court.
I was hearing. Thanks for having me on.
So, want to get an update from you about our involvement in Yemen. Joe Biden on the campaign trail, and I think actually maybe as president in those early days, said we are done with this. The Biden administration publicly announced that we would no longer support offensive actions by Saudi Arabia in its bombing and within Yemen. And people were a little skeptical as to what that meant. And it really appears that skepticism was warranted. Will you catch us up? And for those people who don't understand what's going on in terms of the conflict within Yemen and the outside forces that are implicated, will you just catch everybody up on that?
Yes. So exactly as you said, a year ago, Biden had said that the U.S., you know, he said this war must end and that the U.S. was going to end the sale of offensive weapons. And unfortunately, a year later, what we've seen now is actually the potential for U.S. Escalation and the further involvement of the U.S. in this conflict due to the fact people may have heard about the attacks that the Houthis have been sending at the UAE. And in response, the U.S. has now sent the USS Cole, a destroyer warship, as well as multiple fighter aircraft. And the scary possibility is that what if the Houthis hit an American soldier stationed in the UAE or stationed in Saudi Arabia? Then what's Biden going to do? Is he going to launch a war on the Houthis? You know, a year ago, he seemed determined to pull out and to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led war. And yet here we are escalating our presence.
Well, but it was so clear the language he used. And I remember honestly saying at the time, offensive operations, we're going to end our financial support. I mean, that is very parsed language, and that's on purpose, right? They want to still be able to send the arms and the weaponry that Saudi Arabia needs for its defensive operations, which just means that the blockade continues, and to help support the blockade, okay, we're going to continue our bombing campaign. So, like, there's really no fundamental difference there. And was that reality reflected on the ground in terms of the arms that we gave?
Totally. So this offensive defensive distinction is doing so much work here. And unfortunately, we see members of Congress also buying into this. And the point is, we've sold Saudi Arabia hundreds of billions of dollars of offensive weapons. So they already have all of those. And what we've sold subsequently, this is where it gets to this question of, like, well, is it an offensive or a defensive weapon? If it's being used to enforce the blockade, that is inherently an offensive action. This whole Saudi-led war is an offensive action being conducted upon Yemen. And yet, unfortunately, we do see members of Congress that were willing to do things like introduce a successful war powers resolution against President Trump in 2019, which passed. This was the first time we saw Congress asserting its authority granted in 1973 with the War Powers Act to limit the imperial presidency. Trump vetoed it. And our organization and others are trying to do now is to reintroduce a war powers resolution. But it's a question of, are Democrats going to go against Biden the way they were willing to go against Trump? That, you know, it was clear Trump was just in bed with the Saudis and the Khashoggi thing had just happened. And it was all very distasteful for, I think, a lot of Americans. But now it's, you know, I think people are getting a little bit confused. And the fact is, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are killing Yemen and the U.S. is completely complicit.
Okay. For the sake of that, for clarification, will you just give us a remedial rundown on the conflict in Yemen and the supposed, the conventional wisdom as to who is backing the Houthis and who are the different players here? And in some respect, this is a surrogate conflict again, like almost like everything in the Middle East, it seems like, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. But just walk us through the different sort of players here so that people can get some clarity in that respect.
Definitely. So the war in Yemen began as a civil war. And it became internationalized in 2015 when the Saudis led a coalition of other Arab countries to kick out the Houthis, who had seized control of the capital. The Houthis are a group of Shia rebels who do receive support from Iran. And this is part of where I think people get confused, is because they hear, well, you know, Iran is supporting the Houthis and we don't like Iran. But the point is, you think about the scale of what Iran smuggles in or assistance that they provide to the Houthis, as opposed to the hundreds of billions of dollars that the U.S. sells to Saudi Arabia and, again, has for decades, as well as the UAE, as well as Israel, the rumors of Israeli involvement in this as well. And thinking about the devastation of Yemen, where the population, 400,000, almost 400,000 people, 400,000 people have died, many of them actually as a result of things like the blockade. So Saudi Arabia is not allowing, is allowing only a tiny fraction of fuel to get into the country, specifically the territory controlled by the Houthis. People are starving. The Saudi coalition continues to target things like hospitals and the internet was knocked out for several days of, just a few weeks ago. And so, again, there's sort of, I think, there's this question of, well, you know, we don't like that Iran is supporting the Houthis, and the Houthis have done horrific things. But the point is, the Houthis are, there are many parallels, in fact, to Afghanistan here, that you have a population so devastated by war that they really don't care anymore. They just want the violence to end, and they're willing to let the Taliban or the Houthis or, you know, these repressive, misogynistic, hyper-religious jerks take over, because they're the ones that are going to be able to reimpose some kind of a survival, the ability of Yemenis to survive or Afghans to survive, and that they are the ones resisting this foreign aggression. And so you have people, whether Afghans or Yemenis, who don't like the fact that this is the group that would take over, but it, that's the only one fighting on their interests against the foreign invaders.
And so,
I'm sorry, just to clarify. So, what is the interest of Saudi Arabia and UAE? I mean, the you know, why is it so incumbent upon them to kill so many Yemeni and to devastate the Houthi?
So originally, Saudi Arabia was involved because they feared Iranian involvement and support for the Houthis. What's ironic is back in 2015, when they were first, the Saudis first invaded, the Iranian relationship to the Houthis was really quite minimal, and it has grown significantly since then. And so the thing the Saudis feared is now a much bigger problem. The other thing is, the Houthis have gained much more territory and much more capacity to launch drones and missiles across the border at Saudi Arabia. And so what had started as kind of a war of choice, and unfortunately the UN backed up the Saudi decision, and this also gets to sort of the international community's complicity in this, where you have the US and the UK and France all mostly interested in continuing to sell weapons to the Saudis rather than trying to end what's happening in Yemen. But the point being that the Saudis at this point essentially would like to find a way out. We know that MBS is instituting massive changes to Saudi society. He needs a lot of money to pull that off. And yet he's just throwing money to devastate Yemen, when actually what Saudi Arabia eventually will need to do is to try to restabilize Yemen, so they don't have this failed state right on their border, where we know there's a history of Al-Qaeda activities, and it's not in Saudi's interest to have Yemen be a total basket case, but at this point, that is what they are creating.
But then whose interest is, I mean, there also is the UAE that is involved here as well. I mean, can you talk a little bit about their involvement and why maybe they might be a little bit more interested in this conflict continuing? Because the Trump administration at the last second designating the Houthis as a terrorist organization, and because of their association with Iran, I think that puts that in some better context. But two, when you do that, and the Biden administration considering doing this is very dangerous, right? Because when you do that, you block all aid that could go to starving Yemenis. And right now it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world for a reason. Starvation, disease is a massive problem there. So I guess that's a two-pronged question. What is the UAE's involvement here? And two, what are the risks involved if the Biden administration is actually going to do, is considering doing what was at the time considered an extreme action by the Trump administration on his way out the door?
Totally. So first to the UAE, we had seen the UAE being involved, a partner of Saudi Arabia in the coalition that got involved in 2015. Interestingly, as I was saying, 2019 was when we saw sort of the high watermark of congressional opposition to this. And it was at the end of 2019 that the UAE said, you know what, we're going to withdraw. And withdrew most of their military. They continued to hold key locations, places like the island of Socotra, key ports, for example, because Yemen, the edge of Yemen is the Bab al-Mandab Strait, which is the southern access to the Red Sea, Suez Canal, Mediterranean, and Europe. So it's a crucial waterway. And the UAE would like in the future to have, whether it's a future independent South Yemen or just an autonomous Southern Yemen, be essentially serve as there as a client state for the UAE to sort of expand their control again of this crucial waterway. But they had decided they weren't interested in fighting the Houthis over it because they could just kind of control the South and that was fine. And it was only after we saw these meetings between White House officials, the Saudis and Emiratis, that then we saw the UAE escalating their involvement, which then precipitated the UAE-backed militia groups retaking territory, which then prompted the Houthis to fire at the UAE to say, hey, it was fine when you guys were just hanging out in the south. We're not interested in that territory. Now we're going to attack you and really potentially seriously damage the UAE's economy, which is, you know, dependent on oil, but also very dependent on tourism and being seen as this bastion of stability for commerce and investment in the region. And so now the question is, what is the UAE going to do here? And what we've seen from the US is sending this escalating support to convince the UAE to stay involved. To your point about the foreign terrorist organization, the FTO designation of the Houthis, what's so ironic is the Trump administration only did that at the very 11th hour of his presidency because they knew it would be a debacle given the humanitarian implications. And they didn't actually want to have to deal with that. And so they did it at the very end. So Biden would have to be the one that lifted it and deal with the potential political ramifications of that, of which there were almost none because condemnation of that designation was unanimous, that it would not constrain the Houthis' ability to act and organize as a group, but it would devastate the people of Yemen because the Houthis control the territory where 80% of Yemen's population lives. So 30 million people in Yemen, 24 million people live in Houthi-controlled areas. So it would not only prevent any sort of aid from reaching those 24 million people, it would prevent any sort of legitimate financial transaction from taking place either. I mean, again, we're seeing this sort of right now in Afghanistan with the sanctions put on the Taliban, that you cannot send money to family in Afghanistan. You cannot, businesses cannot operate. Even if there are humanitarian exceptions, no business really wants to worry about getting on the wrong side of the Department of Treasury and getting themselves in legal trouble just to sell goods to starving Afghans or starving Yemenis. So the fact that the Biden administration is about to do something that even the Trump administration knew they didn't really want to deal with being responsible for further immiserating the people of Yemen. Biden is considering doing this himself and taking that on, again, just because we continue to see, unfortunately, the Biden administration just going back to this same old script of just unconditional support for the Saudis and the Emiratis and this sort of reactive antipathy towards Iran. You know, the JCPOA being a whole other question here of why didn't Biden just get right back into it? What's going on? Even if they managed to get back into it, to what extent would it even be successful?
All right. So there's two things that one, to what extent has been the failure of the American people to engage, care, speak out against what's happening in Afghanistan, open the door for this designation for the Houthi? I mean, somebody somewhere in the White House is saying, we're not paying a price for starving Afghanistan, and we were there for 20 years and we obliterated that population. We couldn't be more involved and responsible for the Afghani people and yet there's no public outcry about what's happening there. Occasionally a story in the New York Times, you know, and that's it. I mean, how much does that open the door for this designation? And then sort of a subsidiary question, how much does the fact that oil went up 7 cents a gallon this past week, or the gas went up 7 cents a gallon. I don't know what it is. A barrel of oil is now like getting close to what, you know, one of its peaks. How much does that play into this when the Biden administration is thinking, you know, for 2022, we really need gas prices to fall, and we need OPEC and Saudi Arabia to pump more gas, I mean, more oil. So how much of those two factors weigh at this? One is like a, there's no constraint on one hand, and on the other hand, there's an incentive to appease Saudi Arabia because of political considerations here.
Totally. I think that's a super important point. When you think about the number, just the pages of ink spilled about, well, we have to protect Afghan women and we have to stay there. And in 20 years of this, of like, it is our responsibility to save the women of Afghanistan. And, you know, dead women can't go to school. Like we, the fact that now the American people seem to really be fine with the starvation of Afghanistan imposed by the United States, I think is clearly, I think that's a great point about the Biden administration suspects they would not pay a political cost for the further devastation of Yemen. In terms of the question of gas prices, obviously that is likely a consideration. But, you know, ironically, there are other decisions the Biden administration could make if they want to keep gas prices low. One of them would be bringing Iran back into the global oil market. That would bring production capacity way back up and would also limit the ability of the Saudis to drag us around and force us to comply with policies of theirs. That, again, Americans for a long time have wondered, why do we continue to support this regime that behaves in ways that are so inimical to American values when we're not even dependent on Saudi oil anymore? Sure, it's all a global market and the price, you know, the Saudis can have a big influence on the price. But again, the point being, if it were really about oil prices, there are a lot of other policies that the U.S. government could undertake if that were really the driving factor here. I think what an important thing to keep in mind is that the Biden administration, unfortunately, after initially signaling that we were going to do this pivot to China and the Middle East is not as important of a priority, you know, we're ending the endless wars and we're getting out. Instead of actually doing that, what we've seen is that this competition with China, the Biden administration thinks is going to happen in the Middle East, which is why they think it's so important to maintain these super strong relationships with our security partners. But the point is, we haven't seen China exhibiting any interest in taking on playing the really botched role the U.S. has played in the region. I mean, why would China want to follow our example in the Middle East? They're really just interested in economic partnerships, and they're very good at that. And I think the U.S. unfortunately knows that the only area where we compete is on weapons sales. We can't necessarily compete with China on economic partnerships, even though I think we should be trying a lot harder and not trying to tie our entire sort of alliance structure to our ability to sell other people weapons, because again, it just creates blowback and continues to generate these situations where the U.S. is then forced to become more involved. So again, if something happens and we're sort of dragged backwards into another war in the Middle East, Americans are so fed up with this and really ready. We're really initially, I think, welcomed the Biden administration's push to say no more unnecessary wars in the Middle East.
What's stunning about what you've just laid out in terms of the Biden administration thinking that the Middle East is the key to our, fight for supremacy or equilibrium with China, it's exactly, I'm quite convinced, was a major reason why we invaded Iraq. Because it was certainly the Cheneys who felt in the year 2000, and we can go back, and I interviewed Gary Hart about this when they were doing the 21st century threat. It was Lynn Cheney or Liz Cheney, one of the Cheneys, who was sitting in that, as everyone was saying, non-state actors. She was insisting it was China. And so this was China was on their mind in the late 90s. It was in their mind in the, you know, the New World Order following the 93 fall of the Soviet Union. And the idea that this has currency in the Biden White House is just absurd.
Well, there are a lot of Bush carryovers and people like Brett McGurk, who really is running Middle East policy right now and is driving this possible redesignation of the Houthis as a terrorist organization. This is who these people are. I mean, this is the blob, the foreign policy establishment that never faced any kind of, they were never held accountable for the debacle of the Iraq war. You know, people failed up. And we continue to see that. I think you're absolutely right that if 9/11 hadn't happened, we likely would have seen this kind of pivot to Asia a lot earlier. And instead, we got bogged down in the Middle East for two decades to the detriment of our own security, you know, arguably the amount of resources, the amount of terrorist groups there are now. It's insane sort of the way U.S. policy has gone for the past 20 years. And now we're sort of gearing up against China, this notion that we have to raise our defense budgets and we might be going to war with Russia in the coming days. We have to be prepared to fight two great powers when for the past 20 years, our entire military has been focused on counterinsurgencies, which did not make the U.S. safer and instead have only drained resources that really needed to be going to the American people, to actual threats like climate change, for example.
Well, you mentioned Russia. What is, and I know this is not necessarily your portfolio, but maybe, you know, in the commissary there, what is your sense about where we're at this point? Are there indications that things are starting to at least maybe de-escalate or what?
I mean, I think, you know, we've heard President Biden try to deflate some of these notions that we're actually going to go to war with Russia over this. And, you know, the Americans have been very clear about this. But again, unfortunately, what you see, at least here in Washington, is all just the rhetoric about the absolute necessity of having Ukraine join NATO and just all of these questions that unfortunately you get such an echo chamber of people emphasizing these talking points that are so disconnected from the fact that we're supposed to be a democracy and our foreign policy should reflect what's actually good for the American people. And the average American, you know, regardless of concerns about Russia and meddling, et cetera, I think, unfortunately, a lot of this also ties into domestic politics and these concerns about what Putin is doing, et cetera, all of which are legitimate concerns. But again, that doesn't, you know, fighting with Russia over Ukraine is not going to address those concerns. So I agree with you that I think it's encouraging that thus far, maybe things are moving towards de-escalation, but the really alarming thing is whether it's a crisis in Ukraine or a American gets killed by a militia in Iraq, or something happens in the South China Sea, that this town shifts so fast into war making, warmongering, and then war making, and this is, you know, part of what groups like mine are trying to push back against is to say no, there's that should not be our hair trigger response. And we need to really think about what is in our own national interest here.
Let me just ask you one thing about the domestic politics. It was Russia's involvement to the extent that it actually had any implications, who knows, but Russian involvement in the 2016 and to some extent 2020 election. How is it that the Republicans, who are ostensibly not so concerned about that Russian interference, were the ones who are pushing for preemptive sanctions as opposed to conditional sanctions, which it seems, broadly speaking, the Democrats want conditioned sanctions. Sanctions kick in if you invade Ukraine. The Republicans are saying, well, we'll have those, but we also want some other ones to do. Like, what is that? What is behind their just wanting to sanction now, as opposed to if you do the thing we don't want you to do?
Well, Sam, I think your demand is a certain level of logical consistency from politicians that, you know, we're I don't know if we're ever going to get there. But you know, I think in general, as I was saying, this town runs on funding war. And you think about just like the amount of contributions members of Congress and senators get from the big five weapons contractors and other defense contractors. The U.S. weapons industry is such a powerful lobby. And so, you know, there's been great research done on not only that question, but, you know, other questions in terms of, like support for escalating the DOD's budget, which we're now approaching $1 trillion a year that we are sending to this one department of the U.S. government. And just there's such a direct correlation between, you know, who gets donations from these kinds of corporations and then what sort of policies are they implementing. So in general, we know that there's a stronger anti-war movement on the left, just historically, that's been part of our history. And so you have more Democrats in Congress who have constituencies who are pushing back on them and saying, no, we're not interested in another war and, you know, don't even think about it. Whereas on the right, there's not as much of that kind of a tradition, unfortunately. And, you know, we are seeing certain organizations, like one of our funders, the Koch brothers, the Charles Koch Foundation, is interested in creating more space for that. We see that also coming from libertarians on the far right or on the right who don't necessarily like the amount of money that goes into the Pentagon and don't like the amount of then sort of militarization of police and, you know, what we observe meted out upon Americans, as we especially observed in 2020. But again, it's much smaller on the right. And so this is, I think, to answer your question, why you can see Republicans holding these sort of logically contradictory positions where they're advocating for war with Russia or broad-based sanctions against Russia, and at the same time seem really okay with the notion of, you know, maybe Russian meddling, who cares?
Well, it is, it hopefully, some cooler heads will prevail, and maybe we can get, you know, that generation of neocons that have been embedded themselves in our national security apparatus. I don't know. Maybe it's just going to take attrition, essentially. Dr. Anil Shaleen, Middle East Research Fellow at the Quincy Institute, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for your ongoing efforts to draw attention to Yemen. It's really important.
Thank you.
Thanks so
much. All right, folks. Extra show today. Extra freebie show. So if you have the, but they're both things that we wanted to get to, and we were just too booked up this week. So we doubled up.
We doubled up.
I'm not going to apologize for that.
Yeah, I mean, no one's asking you to.
All right.
Maybe next day we'll triple up, huh?
Well, we'll see. Folks, you can support this program. You can support the free half by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, you not only support the free half and indulge us when we got to double up because we just got too many great guests that are booked over the course of a week to bring you a better understanding of how the court systems work in this country or our involvement in Yemen and what's behind some of these incredibly stupid and counterproductive and inhumane actions that we take as a government, as a society. I can't remember what I was talking about at that point. I lost my train of thought, but you can support all that, not the inhumane stuff, but just the talking about it.
And you can also support you if you're going to be on any shows in the near future.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go to jointhemajorityreport.com, and also you can watch me tonight on a show called Doomed. It is the 200th episode.
Wow.
Of Matt Binder's Doomed. And it's the, I think it's going to be the first time that Matt Binder will be interviewing me. In fact, it'll probably be the longest conversation we've ever had, contiguous. It's, you know, I mean, I don't know if that's 100% true, but it's possible. I mean, right. Just like sheer one-on-one, just sitting there, focused on each other.
First time he's had a CIA operative on his program as well.
I doubt that, but it's certainly going to be the most prominent CIA operative that he's had
yeah,
on.
Yeah, makes sense.
So you can check that out. Matt Binder's Doomed tonight, 9 p.m. Maybe there's a chance you will hear my children yelling in the background.
Hmm.
Hopefully I can get the youngest one to sleep by then. There's a lot of craziness going on at the house right now. The apartment.
Whatever. Yeah.
All right. Don't forget, jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. And don't forget those live shows, Majority Live. Matt, what's happening in the MLU?
I don't know if I like that. Tomorrow night on Left Reckon, we're going to have Mike Prisoner of the Empire Files on, talking about Ukraine, Afghanistan, the Red Hill Fuel Facility in Hawaii, and Abby Martin's legal fight against anti-BDS legislation in Georgia. A certain free speech issue you don't hear much about, but she fought this bill that said you have to take a loyalty oath to speak in Georgia, and they won, and then Georgia got together and changed the bill to like take away that victory, and changed it to only if you're getting paid $100,000 or more, do you have to take the loyalty oath.
Oh, so then they got to refile if they want to fight that.
Yeah, so now I guess it's like, and it was done with like Israeli help apparently in the state house, and it's. And so now it's she can't, because they're not going to pay her $100,000 to speak there, so she won't have standing to challenge.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
She's relentless, though. That's a great guess.
Just to be clear,
that's awesome.
There are, I don't know how many states in the country, there are maybe 30 states or something like that, where, and this came out, it got wide publicity in Texas, where I think it was a speech therapist, was contracted by a school system in Texas to provide speech therapy for some kids, some students. And she refused to sign this pledge that said, if you're a state contractor, that you will not boycott Israeli products. And she was like, what? And I think she successfully won that case. Then
after The Intercept highlighted her story, we should say too, if you want to check out that full thing, they did a video interview with her as well.
And then Little Marco and other, I think, I can't remember who else, other Republicans tried to introduce this on a federal level where you would, and this is what, just to extend this story, Ilhan Omar, when those first comments that they tried to censure her for, when she first got into Congress, this is what she was referring to when she said, I'm not going to take some type of pledge to another country. And they made it as if she was accusing Jewish people for having dual loyalty, when in fact she was specifically talking about an attempt on the federal level and one that exists on the state level to literally sign a loyalty pledge that you will not boycott or participate in a boycott or a divestment move of Israel. And all of this has been obscured by
racism against Ilhan Omar.
Racism against Ilhan Omar, obscured by the media that, for whatever reason, and some on the right who are really concerned about...
I was just about to say. I mean, where are the free speech warriors here? They should be pounding the pavement
every
day.
What would have imagined? The IDW would have been trumpeting this. I mean,
Glenn Greenwald, Barry Weiss. I mean, like, they need to be on this. First Amendment
warriors. I think Greenwald
warriors.
Has spoken out against this. Barry Weiss, not in a million years.
Barry Weiss is, like, probably working the other end of it.
Of course. Without a doubt.
But I mean, I've heard a lot about censorship from her. So,
No. The IDW. This is, I mean, talk about the dark web. I mean, this is what they should have been talking
it's
about.
It's interesting
but they
what gets emphasized and when the dog barks and when the dog doesn't bark on certain things.
That's a good way of putting it. I think you need to grow up in North Dakota to have that say. All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is it me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go try
that. Libertarians.
They're so stupid, though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So, what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt.
Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out.
I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.